David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. Written and read by Malcolm Gladwell.
For AL and SF, a real underdog. Introduction. Goliath. But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord does not see as mortals see. They look on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." 1 Samuel 16:7. Am I a dog that you should come to me with sticks? 1. At the heart of ancient Palestine is the region known as the Shephelah, a series of ridges and valleys connecting the Judean mountains to the east with the wide, flat expanse of the Mediterranean plain. It is an area of breathtaking beauty, home to vineyards and wheat fields and forests of sycamore and terebinth. It is also of great strategic importance. Over the centuries, numerous battles have been fought for control of the region because the valleys rising from the Mediterranean plain offer those on the coast a clear path to the cities of Hebron, Bethlehem, and Jerusalem in the Judean highlands. The most important valley is Ajalon in the north, but the most storied is the Elah. The Elah was where Saladin faced off against the Knights of the Crusades in the 12th century. It played a central role in the Maccabean Wars with Syria more than 1,000 years before that. And, most famously, during the days of the Old Testament, it was where the fledgling Kingdom of Israel squared off against the armies of the Philistines. The Philistines were from Crete. They were a seafaring people who had moved to Palestine and settled along the coast. The Israelites were clustered in the mountains, under the leadership of King Saul. In the second half of the 11th century BCE, the Philistines began moving east, winding their way upstream along the floor of the Elah Valley. Their goal was to capture the mountain ridge near Bethlehem and split Saul's kingdom in two. The Philistines were battle-tested and dangerous, and the sworn enemies of the Israelites. Alarmed, Saul gathered his men and hastened down from the mountains to confront them. The Philistines set up camp along the southern ridge of the Elah. The Israelites pitched their tents on the other side, along the northern ridge, which left the two armies looking across the ravine at each other. Neither dared to move. To attack meant descending down the hill and then making a suicidal climb up the enemy's ridge on the other side. Finally, the Philistines had enough. They sent their greatest warrior down the valley to resolve the deadlock one-on-one. He was a giant, 6'9" at least, wearing a bronze helmet and full body armor. He carried a javelin, a spear, and a sword. An attendant preceded him, carrying a large shield. The giant faced the Israelites and shouted out, "Choose you a man, and let him come down to me. If he prevail in battle against me and strike me down, we shall be slaves to you. But if I prevail and strike him down, you will be slaves to us and serve us." In the Israelite camp, no one moved. Who could win against such a terrifying opponent? Then a shepherd boy, who had come down from Bethlehem to bring food to his brothers, stepped forward and volunteered. Saul objected. "You cannot go against this Philistine and do battle with him, for you are a lad, and he is a man of war from his youth." But the shepherd was adamant. He had faced more ferocious opponents than this, he argued. When the lion or the bear would come and carry off a sheep from the herd, he told Saul, "I would go after him and strike him down and rescue it from his clutches." Saul had no other options. He relented, and the shepherd boy ran down the hill towards the giant standing in the valley. "Come to me, that I may give your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field," the giant cried out when he saw his opponent approach. Thus began one of history's most famous battles. The giant's name was Goliath. The shepherd boy's name was David. 2. David and Goliath is a book about what happens when ordinary people confront giants. By giants, I mean powerful opponents of all kinds, from armies and mighty warriors to disability, misfortune, and oppression. Each chapter tells the story of a different person, famous or unknown, ordinary or brilliant, who has faced an outsized challenge and been forced to respond. Should I play by the rules or follow my own instincts? Should I persevere or give up? Should I strike back or forgive? Through these stories, I want to explore two ideas. The first is that much of what we consider valuable in our world arises out of these kinds of lopsided conflicts, because the act of facing overwhelming odds produces greatness and beauty. And second, that we consistently get these kinds of conflicts wrong. We misread them. We misinterpret them. Giants are not what we think they are. The same qualities that appear to give them strength are often the sources of great weakness. And the fact of being an underdog can change people in ways that we often fail to appreciate. It can open doors and create opportunities and educate and enlighten and make possible what might otherwise have seemed unthinkable. We need a better guide to facing giants, and there is no better place to start that journey than with the epic confrontation between David and Goliath 3,000 years ago in the Valley of Elah. When Goliath shouted out to the Israelites, he was asking for what was known as single combat. This was a common practice in the ancient world. Two sides in a conflict would seek to avoid the heavy bloodshed of open battle by choosing one warrior to represent them in a duel. For example, the 1st century BCE Roman historian Quintus Claudius Quadrigarius tells of an epic battle in which a Gaul warrior began mocking his Roman opponents. This immediately aroused the great indignation of one Titus Manlius, a youth of the highest birth, Quadrigarius writes. Titus challenged the Gaul to a duel. He stepped forward and would not suffer Roman valor to be shamefully tarnished by a Gaul. Armed with a legionary shield and a Spanish sword, he confronted the Gaul. Their fight took place on the very bridge over the Anio River, in the presence of both armies, amid great apprehension. Thus they confronted each other. The Gaul, according to his method of fighting, with shield advanced and waiting an attack. Manlius, relying on courage rather than skill, struck shield against shield and threw the Gaul off balance. While the Gaul was trying to regain the same position, Manlius again struck shield against shield and again forced the man to change his ground. In this fashion, he slipped under the Gaul's sword and stabbed him in the chest with his Spanish blade. After he had slain him, Manlius cut off the Gaul's head, tore off his tongue, and put it, covered as it was with blood, around his own neck. This is what Goliath was expecting, a warrior like himself to come forward for hand-to-hand combat. It never occurred to him that the battle would be fought on anything other than those terms, and he prepared accordingly. To protect himself against blows to the body, he wore an elaborate tunic made up of hundreds of overlapping bronze fish-like scales. It covered his arms and reached to his knees and probably weighed more than 100 pounds. He had bronze shin guards protecting his legs, with attached bronze plates covering his feet. He wore a heavy metal helmet. He had three separate weapons, all optimized for close combat. He held a thrusting javelin made entirely of bronze, which was capable of penetrating a shield or even armor. He had a sword on his hip, and, as his primary option, he carried a special kind of short-range spear with a metal shaft as thick as a weaver's beam. It had a cord attached to it and an elaborate set of weights that allowed it to be released with extraordinary force and accuracy. As the historian Moshe Garcia writes, to the Israelites this extraordinary spear, with its heavy shaft plus long and heavy iron blade, when hurled by Goliath's strong arm, seemed capable of piercing any bronze shield and bronze armor together. Can you see why no Israelite would come forward to fight Goliath? Then David appears. Saul tries to give him his own sword and armor, so at least he'll have a fighting chance. David refuses. I cannot walk in these, he says, for I am unused to it. Instead, he reaches down and picks up 5 smooth stones. And puts them in his shoulder bag. Then he descends into the valley, carrying his shepherd's staff. Goliath looks at the boy coming towards him and is insulted. He was expecting to do battle with a seasoned warrior. Instead, he sees a shepherd, a boy from the lowliest of all professions, who seems to want to use his shepherd's staff as a cudgel against Goliath's sword. Am I a dog, Goliath says, gesturing at the staff, that you should come to me with sticks? What happens next is a matter of legend. David puts one of his stones into the leather pouch of a sling, and he fires at Goliath's exposed forehead. Goliath falls, stunned. David runs towards him, seizes the giant's sword, and cuts off his head. The Philistines saw that their warrior was dead, the biblical account reads, and they fled. The battle is won miraculously by an underdog who, by all expectations, should not have won at all. This is the way we have told one another the story over the many centuries since. It is how the phrase David and Goliath has come to be embedded in our language as a metaphor for improbable victory. And the problem with that version of the events is that almost everything about it is wrong. 3. Ancient armies had three kinds of warriors. The first was cavalry, armed men on horseback or in chariots. The second was infantry, foot soldiers wearing armor and carrying swords and shields. The third were projectile warriors, or what today would be called artillery, archers and, most important, slingers. Slingers had a leather pouch attached on two sides by a long strand of rope. They would put a rock or a lead ball into the pouch, swing it around in increasingly wider and faster circles, and then release one end of the rope, hurling the rock forward. Slinging took an extraordinary amount of skill and practice. But in experienced hands, the sling was a devastating weapon. Paintings from medieval times show slingers hitting birds in mid-flight. Irish slingers were said to be able to hit a coin from as far away as they could see it. And in the Old Testament book of Judges, slingers are described as being accurate within a hair's breadth. An experienced slinger could kill or seriously injure a target at a distance of up to 200 yards. The Romans even had a special set of tongs made just to remove stones that had been embedded in some poor soldier's body by a sling. Imagine standing in front of a Major League Baseball pitcher as he aims a baseball at your head. That's what facing a slinger was like. Only what was being thrown was not a ball of cork and leather, but a solid rock. The historian Baruch Halpern argues that the sling was of such importance in ancient warfare that the three kinds of warriors balanced each other, like each gesture in a game of rock, paper, scissors. With their long pikes and armor, infantry could stand up to cavalry. Cavalry could, in turn, defeat projectile warriors, because the horses moved too quickly for artillery to take proper aim. And projectile warriors were deadly against infantry, because a big lumbering soldier, weighed down with armor, was a sitting duck for a slinger who was launching projectiles from 100 yards away. This is why the Athenian expedition to Sicily failed in the Peloponnesian War, Halpern writes. Thucydides describes at length how Athens' heavy infantry was decimated in the mountains by local light infantry, principally using the sling. Goliath is heavy infantry. He thinks that he's going to be engaged in a duel with another heavy infantryman, in the same manner as Titus Manlius's fight with the Gaul. When he says, "Come to me, that I may give your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field," the key phrase is, "Come to me." He means, "Come right up to me so we can fight at close quarters." When Saul tries to dress David in armor and give him a sword, he is operating under the same assumption. He assumes David is going to fight Goliath hand to hand. David, however, has no intention of honoring the rituals of single combat. When he tells Saul that he has killed bears and lions as a shepherd, he does so not just as testimony to his courage, but to make another point as well, that he intends to fight Goliath the same way he has learned to fight wild animals, as a projectile warrior. He runs towards Goliath, because without armor, he has speed and maneuverability. He puts a rock into his sling and whips it around and around, faster and faster at 6 or 7 revolutions per second, aiming his projectile at Goliath's forehead, the giant's only point of vulnerability. Eitan Hirsch, a ballistics expert with the Israeli Defense Forces, recently did a series of calculations showing that a typical size stone hurled by an expert slinger at a distance of 35 meters would have hit Goliath's head with a velocity of 34 meters per second, more than enough to penetrate his skull and render him unconscious or dead. In terms of stopping power, That is equivalent to a fair-sized modern handgun. We find, Hirsch writes, that David could have slung and hit Goliath in little more than 1 second, a time so brief that Goliath would not have been able to protect himself, and during which he would be stationary for all practical purposes. What could Goliath do? He was carrying over 100 pounds of armor. He was prepared for a battle at close range, where he could stand immobile, warding off blows with his armor and delivering a mighty thrust of his spear. He watched David approach, first with scorn, then with surprise, and then with what can only have been horror, as it dawned on him that the battle he was expecting had suddenly changed shape. "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin," David said to Goliath, "but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord, and he will give all of you into our hands." Twice David mentions Goliath's sword and spear, as if to emphasize how profoundly different his intentions are. Then he reaches into his shepherd's bag for a stone, and at that point, no one watching from the ridges on either side of the valley would have considered David's victory improbable. David was a slinger, and slingers beat infantry, hands down. Goliath had as much chance against David, the historian Robert Dorenrand writes, as any Bronze Age warrior with a sword would have had against an opponent armed with a .45 automatic pistol. 4. Why has there been so much misunderstanding about that day in the Valley of Elah? On one level, the duel reveals the folly of our assumptions about power. The reason King Saul is skeptical of David's chances is that David is small and Goliath is large. Saul thinks of power in terms of physical might. He doesn't appreciate that power can come in other forms as well, in breaking rules, in substituting speed and surprise for strength. Saul is not alone in making this mistake. In what follows, I'm going to argue that we continue to make that error today in ways that have consequences for everything from the way we educate our children to the way we fight crime and disorder. But there's a second, deeper issue here. Saul and the Israelites think they know who Goliath is. They size him up and jump to conclusions about what they think he is capable of. But they do not really see him. The truth is that Goliath's behavior is puzzling. He's supposed to be a mighty warrior, but he's not acting like one. He comes down to the valley floor accompanied by an attendant, a servant walking before him, carrying a shield. Shield bearers in ancient times often accompanied archers into battle, because a soldier using a bow and arrow had no free hand to carry any kind of protection on his own. But why does Goliath, a man calling for sword-on-sword single combat, need to be assisted by a third party carrying an archer's shield? What's more, why does he say to David, "Come to me"? Why can't Goliath go to David? The biblical account emphasizes how slowly Goliath moves, which is an odd thing to say about someone who is alleged to be a battle hero of infinite strength. In any case, why doesn't Goliath respond much sooner to the sight of David coming down the hillside without any sword or shield or armor? When he first sees David, his first reaction is to be insulted, when he should be terrified. He seems oblivious of what's happening around him. There is even that strange comment after he finally spots David with his shepherd's staff. "Am I a dog that you should come to me with sticks?" Sticks, plural? David is holding only one stick. What many medical experts now believe, in fact, is that Goliath had a serious medical condition. He looks and sounds like someone suffering from what is called acromegaly, a disease caused by a benign tumor of the pituitary gland. The tumor causes an overproduction of human growth hormone, which would explain Goliath's extraordinary size. The tallest person in history, Robert Wadlow, suffered from acromegaly. At his death, he was 8 foot 11 inches and apparently still growing. And furthermore, one of the common side effects of acromegaly is vision problems. Pituitary tumors can grow to the point where they compress the nerves leading to the eyes, with the result that people with acromegaly often suffer from severely restricted sight and diplopia, or double vision. Why was Goliath led onto the valley floor by an attendant? Because the attendant was his visual guide. Why does he move so slowly? because the world around him is a blur. Why does it take him so long to understand that David has changed the rules? Because he doesn't see David until David is up close. "Come to me, that I may give your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field," he shouts out. And in that request, there is a hint of his vulnerability. "I need you to come to me because I cannot locate you otherwise." And then there is the otherwise inexplicable, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" David had only one stick. Goliath saw two. What the Israelites saw from high on the ridge was an intimidating giant. In reality, the very thing that gave the giant his size was also the source of his greatest weakness. There is a powerful lesson in that for battles with all kinds of giants. The powerful and the strong are not always what they seem. David came running towards Goliath, powered by courage and faith. Goliath was blind to his approach, and then he was down, too big and slow and blurry-eyed to comprehend the way the tables had been turned. All these years, we've been telling these kinds of stories wrong. David and Goliath is about getting them right. Part 1. The advantages of disadvantages, and the disadvantages of advantages. Some pretend to be rich, yet have nothing. Others pretend to be poor, yet have great wealth. Proverbs 13:7. Chapter 1. Vivek Ranadive. It was really random. I mean, my father had never played basketball before. 1. When Vivek Ranadive decided to coach his daughter Anjali's basketball team, he settled on two principles. The first was that he would never raise his voice. This was National Junior Basketball, the Little League of Basketball. The team was made up mostly of 12-year-olds, and 12-year-olds, he knew from experience, did not respond well to shouting. He would conduct business on the basketball court, he decided, the same way he conducted business at his software firm. He would speak calmly and softly, and he would persuade the girls of the wisdom of his approach with appeals to reason and common sense. The second principle was more important. Ranadive was puzzled by the way Americans play basketball. He is from Mumbai. He grew up with cricket and soccer. He would never forget the first time he saw a basketball game. He thought it was mindless. Team A would score and then immediately retreat to its own end of the court. Team B would pass the ball in from the sidelines and dribble it into Team A's end, where Team A was patiently waiting. Then the process would reverse itself. A regulation basketball court is 94 feet long. Most of the time, a team would defend only about 24 feet of that, conceding the other 70 feet. Occasionally, teams played a full-court press. That is, they contested their opponent's attempt to advance the ball up the court. But they did it for only a few minutes at a time. It was as if there was a kind of conspiracy in the basketball world about the way the game ought to be played, Ranadive thought, and that conspiracy had the effect of widening the gap between good teams and weak teams. Good teams, after all, had players who were tall and could dribble and shoot well. They could crisply execute their carefully prepared plays in their opponent's end. Why, then, did weak teams play in a way that made it easy for good teams to do the very thing they were so good at? Ranadive looked at his girls. Morgan and Julia were serious basketball players. But Nikki, Angela, Danny, Holly, Annika, and his own daughter Anjali had never played the game before. They weren't that tall. They couldn't shoot. They weren't particularly adept at dribbling. They were not the sort who played pickup games at the playground every evening. Ranadive lives in Menlo Park, in the heart of California's Silicon Valley. His team was made up of, as Ranadive put it, little blonde girls. They were the daughters of nerds and computer programmers. They worked on science projects and read long and complicated books and dreamed about growing up to be marine biologists. Ranadive knew that if they played the conventional way, if they let their opponents dribble the ball up the court without opposition, they would almost certainly lose to the girls for whom basketball was a passion. Ranadive had come to America as a 17-year-old with $50 in his pocket. He was not one to accept losing easily. His second principle, then, was that his team would play a real full-court press, every game, all the time. The team ended up at the national championships. "It was really random," Anjali Ranadive said. "I mean, my father had never played basketball before." 2. Suppose you were to total up all the wars over the past 200 years that occurred between very large and very small countries. Let's say that one side has to be at least 10 times larger in population and armed might than the other. How often do you think the bigger side wins? Most of us, I think, would put that number at close to 100%. A tenfold difference is a lot. But the actual answer may surprise you. When the political scientist Ivan Aragueen Toft did the calculation a few years ago, he came up with 71.5%. Just under a third of the time, the weaker country wins. Aragueen Toft then asked the question slightly differently. What happens in wars between the strong and the weak when the weak side does as David did and refuses to fight the way the bigger side wants to fight, using unconventional or guerrilla tactics? The answer? In those cases, the weaker party's winning percentage climbs from 28.5% to 63.6%. To put that in perspective, the United States' population is 10 times the size of Canada's. If the two countries went to war and Canada chose to fight unconventionally, history would suggest that you ought to put your money on Canada. We think of underdog victories as improbable events. That's why the story of David and Goliath has resonated so strongly all these years. But Aragueen Toft's point is that they aren't at all. Underdogs win all the time. Why then are we so shocked every time a David beats a Goliath? Why do we automatically assume that someone who is smaller or poorer or less skilled is necessarily at a disadvantage? One of the winning underdogs on Aragueen Toft's list, for example, was T.E. Lawrence, or as he is better known, Lawrence of Arabia, who led the Arab revolt against the Turkish army occupying Arabia near the end of the First World War. The British were helping the Arabs in their uprising, and their goal was to destroy the long railroad the Turks had built, running from Damascus deep into the Hejaz desert. It was a daunting task. The Turks had a formidable modern army. Lawrence, by contrast, commanded an unruly band of Bedouin. They were not skilled troops. They were nomads. Sir Reginald Wingate, one of the British commanders in the region, called them an untrained rabble, most of whom have never fired a rifle. But they were tough, and they were mobile. The typical Bedouin soldier carried no more than a rifle, 100 rounds of ammunition, and 45 pounds of flour, which meant that he could travel as much as 110 miles a day across the desert, even in summer. The Bedouin carried no more than a pint of drinking water, since they were so good at finding water in the desert. "Our cards were speed and time, not hitting power," Lawrence wrote. "Our largest available resources were the tribesmen, men quite unused to formal warfare, whose assets were movement, endurance, individual intelligence, knowledge of the country, courage." The 18th century general Maurice de Saxe famously said that the art of war was about legs, not arms, and Lawrence's troops were all legs. In one typical stretch in the spring of 1917, his men dynamited 60 rails and cut a telegraph line at Beauvais on March 24th, sabotaged a train and 25 rails at Abu al-Nam on March 25th, dynamited 15 rails and cut a telegraph line at Istabul Antar on March 27th, raided a Turkish garrison and derailed a train on March 29th, returned to Beauvais and sabotaged the railway line again on March 31st, dynamited 11 rails at Hedia on April 3rd, raided the train line in the area of Wadi Daiji on April 4th and 5th, and attacked twice on April 6th. Lawrence's masterstroke was an assault on the port town of Aqaba. The Turks expected an attack from British ships patrolling the waters of the Gulf of Aqaba to the west. Lawrence decided to attack from the east instead, coming at the city from the unprotected desert. And to do that, he led his men on an audacious 600-mile loop, up from the Hejaz, north into the Syrian desert, and then back down towards Aqaba. This was in summer, through some of the most inhospitable land in the Middle East, and Lawrence tacked on a side trip to the outskirts of Damascus in order to mislead the Turks about his intentions. This year, the valley seemed creeping with horned vipers and puff adders, cobras and black snakes, Lawrence writes in Seven Pillars of Wisdom about one stage in the journey. We could not lightly draw water after dark, for there were snakes swimming in the pools or clustering in knots around their brinks. Twice puff adders came twisting into the alert ring of our debating coffee circle. Three of our men died of bites. Four recovered after great fear and pain and a swelling of the poisoned limb. How we taught treatment was to bind up the part with snake skin plaster and read chapters of the Quran to the sufferer until he died. When they finally arrived at Aqaba, Lawrence's band of several hundred warriors killed or captured 1,200 Turks and lost only two men. The Turks simply had not thought that their opponent would be crazy enough to come at them from the desert. Sir Reginald Wingate called Lawrence's men an untrained rabble. He saw the Turks as the overwhelming favorites. But can you see how strange that was? Having lots of soldiers and weapons and resources, as the Turks did, is an advantage. But it makes you immobile and puts you on the defensive. Meanwhile, movement, endurance, individual intelligence, knowledge of the country, and courage, which Lawrence's men had in abundance, allowed them to do the impossible, namely attack Aqaba from the east, a strategy so audacious the Turks never saw it coming. There is a set of advantages that have to do with material resources, and there is a set that have to do with the absence of material resources. And the reason underdogs win as often as they do is that the latter are sometimes every bit the equal of the former. For some reason, this is a very difficult lesson for us to learn. We have, I think, a very rigid and limited definition of what an advantage is. We think of things as helpful that actually aren't, and think of other things as unhelpful that are. Part one of David and Goliath is an attempt to explore the consequences of that error. When we see the giant, why do we automatically assume the battle is his for the winning? And what does it take to be that person who doesn't accept the conventional order of things as a given, like David, or Lawrence of Arabia, or, for that matter, Vivek Ranadiv and his band of nerdy Silicon Valley girls? 3. Vivek Ranadiv's basketball team played in the National Junior Basketball 7th and 8th grade division, representing Redwood City. The girls practiced at Pay's Place, a gym in nearby San Carlos. Because Ranadiv had never played basketball, he recruited a couple of experts to help him. The first was Roger Craig, a former professional athlete who worked for Ranadiv's software company. After Craig signed on, he recruited his daughter, Ramitra, who had played basketball in college. Ramitra was the kind of person you assigned to guard your opponent's best player in order to render her useless. The girls on the team loved Ramitra. "She has always been like my big sister," Anjali Ranadiv said. "It was so awesome to have her along." Redwood City's strategy was built around the two deadlines that all basketball teams must meet in order to advance the ball. The first is the time allotted for the inbounds pass. When one team scores, a player from the other team takes the ball out of bounds and has 5 seconds to pass it to a teammate on the court. If that deadline is missed, the ball goes to the other team. Usually, that's not an issue, because teams don't hang around to defend against the inbounds pass. They run back to their own end. Redwood City did not do that. Each girl on the team closely shadowed her counterpart. When some teams play the press, the defender plays behind the offensive player she's guarding in order to impede her once she catches the ball. The Redwood City girls, by contrast, played a more aggressive, high-risk strategy. They positioned themselves in front of their opponents to prevent them from catching the inbounds pass in the first place. And they didn't have anyone guard the player throwing the ball in. Why bother? Ranadiv used that extra player as a floater who could serve as a second defender against the other team's best player. "Think about football," Ranadiv said. "The quarterback can run with the ball. He has the whole field to throw to, and it's still damn difficult to complete a pass." Basketball was harder. A smaller court, a 5-second deadline, a heavier, bigger ball. As often as not, the teams Redwood City was playing against simply couldn't make the inbounds pass within the 5-second limit. Or else the inbounding player, panicked by the thought that her 5 seconds were about to be up, would throw the ball away. Or her pass would be intercepted by one of the Redwood City players. Ranadiv's girls were maniacal. The second deadline in basketball requires a team to advance the ball across midcourt into the opponent's end within 10 seconds. And if Redwood City's opponents met the first deadline and were able to make the inbounds pass in time, the girls would turn their attention to the second deadline. They would descend on the girl who had caught the inbounds pass and trap her. Anjali was the designated trapper. She'd sprint over and double-team the dribbler, stretching her long arms high and wide. Maybe she'd steal the ball. Maybe the other player would throw it away in a panic or get bottled up and stalled so that the ref would end up blowing the whistle. When we first started out, no one knew how to play defense or anything, Anjali said. So my dad said, the whole game long, your job is to guard someone and make sure they never get the ball on inbounds plays. It's the best feeling in the world to steal a ball from someone. We would press and steal and do that over and over again. It made people so nervous. There were teams that were a lot better than us that had been playing a long time, and we would beat them. The Redwood City players would jump ahead 4-0, 6-0, 8-0, 12-0. One time they led 25-0. Because they typically got the ball underneath their opponent's basket, they rarely had to attempt the low-percentage long-range shots that require skill and practice. They shot layups. In one of the few games that Redwood City lost that year, only 4 of the team's players showed up. They pressed anyway. Why not? They lost by only 3 points. What that defense did for us is that we could hide our weaknesses, Romicha Craig said. We could hide the fact that we didn't have good outside shooters. We could hide the fact that we didn't have the tallest lineup. Because as long as we played hard on defense, we were getting steals and getting easy layups. I was honest with the girls. I told them, we're not the best basketball team out there. But they understood their roles. A 12-year-old girl would go to war for Remitra. They were awesome, she said. Lawrence attacked the Turks where they were weak, along the farthest deserted outpost of the railroad, and not where they were strong. Redwood City attacked the inbounds pass, the point in a game where the great team is as vulnerable as a weak one. David refused to engage Goliath in close quarters, where he would surely lose. He stood well back, using the full valley as his battlefield. The girls of Redwood City used the same tactic. They defended all 94 feet of the basketball court. The full court press is legs, not arms. It supplants ability with effort. It is basketball for those who, like Lawrence's Bedouin, are quite unused to formal warfare, whose assets are movement, endurance, individual intelligence, and courage. It's an exhausting strategy, Roger Craig said. He and Ranadeev were sitting in a conference room at Ranadeev's software company, reminiscing about their dream season. Ranadeev was at the whiteboard, diagramming the intricacies of the Redwood City press. Craig was sitting at the table. My girls had to be more fit than the others, Ranadeev said. He used to make them run, Craig said, nodding. We followed soccer strategy in practice, Ranadeev said. I would make them run and run and run. I couldn't teach them skills in that short period of time, so all we did was make sure they were fit and had some basic understanding of the game. That's why attitude plays such a big role in this, because you're going to get tired. Ranadeev said, tired, with a note of approval in his voice. His father was a pilot who was jailed by the Indian government because he wouldn't stop challenging the safety of the country's planes. Ranadeev went to MIT after he saw a documentary on the school and decided that it was perfect for him. This was in the 1970s, when going abroad for undergraduate study required the Indian government to authorize the release of foreign currency. And Ranadeev camped outside the office of the governor of the Reserve Bank of India until he got his money. Ranadeev is slender and fine-boned, with a languorous walk and an air of imperturbability. But none of that should be mistaken for nonchalance. The Ranadeevs are relentless. He turned to Craig. What was our cheer again? The two men thought for a moment, then shouted out happily, in unison, 1, 2, 3, attitude! The whole Redwood City philosophy was based on a willingness to try harder than anybody else. One time, some new girls joined the team, Ranadeev said, and so in the first practice I had, I was telling them, look, this is what we're going to do, and I showed them. I said, it's all about attitude. And there was this one new girl on the team, and I was worried she wouldn't get the whole attitude thing. Then we did the cheer, and she said, no, it's not 1, 2, 3, attitude. It's 1, 2, 3, attitude, ha! At which point, Ranadeev and Craig burst out laughing. 4. In January of 1971, the Fordham University Rams played a basketball game against the University of Massachusetts Redmen. The game was in Amherst, at the legendary arena known as the Cage, where the Redmen hadn't lost since December of 1969. Their record was 11-1. The Redmen star was none other than Julius Erving, Dr. J, one of the greatest athletes ever to play the game of basketball. The UMass team was very, very good. Fordham, on the other hand, was a team of scrappy kids from the Bronx and Brooklyn. Their center had torn up his knee the first week of practice and was out, which meant that their tallest player was 6'5". Their starting forward, and forwards are typically almost as tall as centers, was Charlie Yelverton, who was only 6'2". But from the opening buzzer, the Rams launched a full-court press, and they never let up. We jumped out to a 13-6 lead, and it was a war the rest of the way, Digger Phelps, the Fordham coach at the time, recalls. These were tough city kids. We played you 94 feet. We knew that sooner or later, we were going to make you crack. Phelps sent in one indefatigable Irish or Italian kid from the Bronx after another to guard Erving, and one by one, the indefatigable Irish and Italian kids fouled out. None of them were as good as Erving. It didn't matter. Fordham won 87-79. In the world of basketball, there is one story after another like this, about legendary games where David used the full-court press to beat Goliath. Yet the puzzle of the press is that it has never become popular. What did Digger Phelps do this season after his stunning upset of UMass? He never used the full-court press the same way again. And the UMass coach, Jack Lehman, who was humbled in his own gym by a bunch of street kids, did he learn from his defeat and use the press himself the next time he had a team of underdogs? He did not. Many people in the world of basketball don't really believe in the press because it's not perfect. It can be beaten by a well-coached team with adept ball handlers and astute passers. Even Ronadive readily admitted as much. All an opposing team had to do to beat Redwood City was press back. The girls were not good enough to handle a taste of their own medicine. But all these objections miss the point. If Ronadive's girls or Fordham's scrappy overachievers had played the conventional way, they would have lost by 30 points. The press was the best chance the underdog had of beating Goliath. Logically, every team that comes in as an underdog should play that way, shouldn't they? So why don't they? Arguin Toft found the same puzzling pattern. When an underdog fought like David, he usually won. But most of the time, underdogs didn't fight like David. Of the 202 lopsided conflicts in Arguin Toft's database, the underdog chose to go toe-to-toe with Goliath the conventional way 152 times, and lost 119 times. In 1809, the Peruvians fought the Spanish straight up and lost. In 1816, the Georgians fought the Russians straight up and lost. In 1817, the Pindaris fought the British straight up and lost. In the Kandyan Rebellion of 1817, the Sri Lankans fought the British straight up and lost. In 1823, the Burmese chose to fight the British straight up and lost. The list of failures is endless. In the 1940s, the communist insurgency in Vietnam bedeviled the French until in 1951, the Vietnamese switched to conventional warfare and promptly suffered a series of defeats. George Washington did the same thing in the American Revolution, abandoning the guerrilla tactics that had served the colonists so well in the conflict's early stages. As quickly as he could, William Polk writes in Violent Politics, A History of Unconventional Warfare, Washington devoted his energies to creating a British-type army, the Continental Line. As a result, he was defeated time after time and almost lost the war. It makes no sense unless you think back to Lawrence's long march across the desert to Aqaba. It is easier to dress soldiers in bright uniforms and have them march to the sound of a fife and drum corps than it is to have them ride 600 miles through snake-infested desert on the back of a camel. It is easier and far more satisfying to retreat and compose yourself after every score and execute perfectly choreographed plays than to swarm about, arms flailing, and contest every inch of the basketball court. Underdog strategies are hard. The only person who seemed to have absorbed the lessons of that famous game between Fordham and the University of Massachusetts was a skinny little guard on the UMass freshman team named Rick Pitino. He didn't play that day. He watched, and his eyes grew wide. Even now, more than four decades later, he can name from memory nearly every player on the Fordham team. Yelverton, Sullivan, Maynard, Charles, Zambetti. They came in with the most unbelievable pressing team I'd ever seen, Pitino said. Five guys between 6 feet five and 6 feet. It was unbelievable how they covered ground. I studied it. There is no way they should have beaten us. Nobody beat us at the cage. Pitino became the head coach at Boston University in 1978, when he was 25 years old, and he used the press to take the school to its first NCAA tournament appearance in 24 years. At his next head coaching stop, Providence College, Pitino took over a team that had gone 11-20 the year before. The players were short and almost entirely devoid of talent, a carbon copy of the Fordham Rams. They pressed and ended up one game away from playing for the national championship. Again and again in his career, Pitino has achieved extraordinary things with a fraction of the talent of his competitors. I have so many coaches come in every year to learn the press, Pitino said. He's now the head basketball coach at the University of Louisville, and Louisville has become the mecca for all those Davids trying to learn how to beat Goliath. Then they email me. They tell me they can't do it. They don't know if their players can last. Pitino shook his head. We practice every day for 2 hours, he went on. The players are moving almost 98% of the practice. We spend very little time talking. When we make our corrections, that is, when Pitino and his coaches stop play to give instruction, they are 7-second corrections, so that our heart rate never rests. We are always working. 7 seconds. The coaches who come to Louisville sit in the stands and watch that ceaseless activity and despair. To play by David's rules, you have to be desperate. You have to be so bad that you have no choice. Their teams are just good enough that they know it could never work. Their players could never be convinced to play that hard. They were not desperate enough. But Ronadeev? Oh, he was desperate. You would think, looking at his girls, that their complete inability to pass and dribble and shoot was their greatest disadvantage. But it wasn't, was it? It was what made their winning strategy possible. 5. One of the things that happened to Redwood City the minute the team started winning basketball games is that opposing coaches began to get angry. There was a sense that Redwood City wasn't playing fair, that it wasn't right to use the full-court press against 12-year-old girls who were just beginning to grasp the rudiments of the game. The point of youth basketball, the dissenting chorus said, was to learn basketball skills. Ronadeev's girls, they felt, were not really playing basketball. Of course, you could as easily argue that in playing the press, a 12-year-old girl learned much more valuable lessons, that effort can trump ability, and that conventions are made to be challenged. But the coaches on the other side of Redwood City's lopsided scores were disinclined to be so philosophical. There was one guy who wanted to have a fight with me in the parking lot, Ronadeev said. He was his big guy. He obviously played basketball and football himself, and he saw that skinny foreign guy beating him at his own game. He wanted to beat me up. Roger Craig says that he was sometimes startled by what he saw. The other coaches would be screaming at their girls, humiliating them, shouting at them. They would say to the refs, "That's a foul, that's a foul," but we weren't fouling. We were just playing aggressive defense. One time, we were playing this team from East San Jose, Ronadeev said. They've been playing for years. They were born with the basketball girls. We were just crushing them. We were up something like 20-0. We wouldn't even let them inbound the ball, and the coach got so mad, they took a chair and threw it. He started screaming at his girls, and of course, the more you scream at girls that age, the more nervous they get. Ronadeev shook his head. You should never, ever raise your voice. Finally, the ref physically threw the guy out of the building. I was afraid. I think he couldn't stand it because here were all these blonde-haired girls who were clearly inferior players, and we were killing them. All the qualities that distinguish the ideal basketball player are acts of skill and finely calibrated execution. When the game becomes about effort over ability, it becomes unrecognizable. A shocking mixture of broken plays and flailing limbs and usually competent players panicking and throwing the ball out of bounds. You have to be outside the establishment, a foreigner new to the game, or a skinny kid from New York at the end of the bench, to have the audacity to play it that way. 6. T.E. Lawrence could triumph because he was the farthest thing from a proper British Army officer. He did not graduate with honors from the top English military academy. He was an archaeologist by trade, who wrote dreamy prose. He wore sandals and full Bedouin dress when he went to see his military superiors. He spoke Arabic like a native, and handled a camel as if he had been riding one all his life. He didn't care what people in the military establishment thought about his untrained rabble, because he had little invested in the military establishment. And then there's David. He must have known that duels with Philistines were supposed to proceed formally with the crossing of swords. But he was a shepherd, which in ancient times was one of the lowliest of all professions. He had no stake in the finer points of military ritual. We spend a lot of time thinking about the ways that prestige and resources and belonging to elite institutions make us better off. We don't spend enough time thinking about the ways in which those kinds of material advantages limit our options. Vivek Ranadive stood on the sidelines as the opposing team's parents and coaches heaped abuse on him. Most people would have shrunk in the face of that kind of criticism. Not Ranadive. It was like really random. I mean, my father had never played basketball before. Why should he care what the world of basketball thought of him? Ranadive coached a team of girls who had no talent in a sport he knew nothing about, and every one of those things turned out to be to his advantage. 7. At the Nationals, the Redwood City girls won their first two games. In the third round, their opponents were from somewhere deep in Orange County. Redwood City had to play them on their own court, and the opponents supplied their own referee as well. The game was at 8 o'clock in the morning. The Redwood City players left their hotel at 6 to beat the traffic. It went downhill from there. The referee did not believe in 1-2-3 attitude, ha! He didn't think that playing to deny the inbounds pass was basketball. He began calling one foul after another. They were touch fouls, Craig said. Ticky-tacky stuff. The memory was painful. My girls didn't understand, Ranadive said. The ref called something like 4 times as many fouls on us as on the other team. People were booing, Craig said. It was bad. A 2-to-1 ratio is understandable, but a ratio of 4-to-1? Ranadive shook his head. One girl fouled out. We didn't get blown out. There was still a chance to win, but Ranadive called the press off. He had to. The Redwood City players retreated to their own end and passively watched as their opponents advanced down the court. The Redwood City girls did not run. They paused and deliberated between each possession. They played basketball the way basketball is supposed to be played, and in the end, they lost. But not before proving that Goliath is not quite the giant he thinks he is. Chapter 2. Teresa DeBrito. My largest class was 29 kids. Oh, it was fun. 1. When Chippewa Valley Middle School was built, to serve the children of the baby boom, 300 students spilled out of school buses every morning. The building had a line of double doors at the entrance to handle the crush, and the corridors inside seemed as busy as a highway. But that was long ago. The baby boom came and went. The bucolic corner of Connecticut, where Chippewa is located, with its charming colonial-era villages and winding country lanes, was discovered by wealthy families from New York City. Real estate prices rose. Younger families could no longer afford to live in the area. Enrollment dropped to 245 students, then to just over 200. There are now 80 children in the school's sixth grade. Based on the number of students coming up through the region's elementary schools, that number may soon be cut in half, which means that the average class size in the school will soon fall well below the national average. A once crowded school has become an intimate one. Would you send your child to Chippewa Valley Middle School? 2. The story of Vivek Ranadive and the Redwood City girls basketball team suggests that what we think of as an advantage and as a disadvantage is not always correct, that we mix the categories up. In this chapter and the next, I want to apply that idea to two seemingly simple questions about education. I say seemingly because they seem simple, although, as we will discover, they are really anything but. The Chepauk Valley Middle School question is the first of the two simple questions. My guess is that you'd be delighted to have your child in one of those intimate classrooms. Virtually everywhere in the world, parents and policymakers take it for granted that smaller classes are better classes. In the past few years, the governments of the United States, Britain, Holland, Canada, Hong Kong, Singapore, Korea, and China, to name just a few, have all taken major steps to reduce the size of their classrooms. When the governor of California announced sweeping plans to reduce the size of his state's classrooms, his popularity doubled within 3 weeks. Inside of a month, 20 other governors had announced plans to follow suit, and within a month and a half, the White House announced class size reduction plans of its own. To this day, 77% of Americans think that it makes more sense to use taxpayer money to lower class sizes than to raise teachers' salaries. Do you know how few things 77% of Americans agree on? There used to be as many as 25 students in a classroom at Chepauk Valley. Now that number is sometimes as low as 15. That means students at Chepauk get far more individual attention from their teacher than before, and common sense says that the more attention children get from their teacher, the better their learning experience will be. Students at the new, intimate Chepauk Valley ought to be doing better at school than students at the old, crowded Chepauk, right? It turns out that there is a very elegant way to test whether this is true. Connecticut has a lot of schools like Chepauk. It's a state with many small towns with small elementary schools, and small schools in small towns are subject to the natural ebbs and flows of birth rates and real estate prices, which means that a grade can be all but empty 1 year and crowded the next. Here are the enrollment records, for example, for the fifth grade in another Connecticut middle school. 1993, 18. 1994, 11. 1995, 17. 1996, 14. 1997, 13. 1998, 16. 1999, 15. 2000, 21. 2001, 23. 2002, 10. 2003, 18. 2004, 21. 2005, 18. In 2001, there were 23 fifth graders. The next year, there were 10. Between 2001 and 2002, everything else in that school remained the same. It had the same teachers, the same principal, the same textbooks. It was in the same building, in the same town. The local economy and the local population were virtually identical. The only thing that changed was the number of students in the fifth grade. If the children in the year with a small number of students did better than the children in the year with lots of students, then we can be pretty sure that it was because of the size of the class, right? This is what's called a natural experiment. Sometimes scientists set up formal experiments to try and test hypotheses. But on rare occasions, the real world provides a natural way of testing the same theory, and natural experiments have many advantages over formal experiments. So what happens if you use the natural experiment of Connecticut and compare the year-to-year results of every child who happens to have been in a small class with the results of those who happen to come along in years with lots of kids? The economist Carolyn Hawksby has done just that, looking at every elementary school in the state of Connecticut, and here's what she found. Nothing. There are many studies that say they can't find a statistically significant effect of some policy change, Hawksby says. That doesn't mean there wasn't an effect. It just means that they couldn't find it in the data. In this study, I found estimates that are very precisely estimated around the point zero. I got a precise zero. In other words, there is no effect. This is just one study, of course. But the picture doesn't get any clearer if you look at all the studies of class size, and there have been hundreds done over the years. 15% find statistically significant evidence that students do better in smaller classes. Roughly the same number find that students do worse in smaller classes. 20% are like Hawksby's and find no effect at all, and the balance find a little bit of evidence in either direction that isn't strong enough to draw any real conclusions. The typical class size study concludes with a paragraph like this. In 4 countries, Australia, Hong Kong, Scotland, and the United States, our identification strategy leads to extremely imprecise estimates that do not allow for any confident assertion about class size effects. In 2 countries, Greece and Iceland, there seem to be non-trivial beneficial effects of reduced class sizes. France is the only country where there seem to be noteworthy differences between mathematics and science teaching. While there is a statistically significant and sizable class size effect in mathematics, a class size effect of comparable magnitude can be ruled out in science. The 9 school systems for which we can rule out large-scale class size effects are Czech Republic, Korea, Portugal, Romania, Slovenia, and Spain. Finally, we can rule out any noteworthy causal effect of class size on student performance in 2 countries, Japan and Singapore. Did you follow that? After sorting through thousands of pages of data on student performance from 18 separate countries, The Economist concluded that there were only 2 places in the world, Greece and Iceland, where there were non-trivial benefits to reduce class sizes. Greece and Iceland? The push to lower class sizes in the United States resulted in something like 250,000 new teachers being hired between 1996 and 2004. Over that same period, per pupil spending in the United States soared 21%, with nearly all of those many tens of billions of new dollars being spent on hiring those extra teachers. It's safe to say that there isn't a single profession in the world that has increased its numbers over the past 2 decades by as much or as quickly or at such expense as teaching has. One country after another has spent that kind of money because we look at a school like Chippewa Valley, where every teacher has a chance to get to know every student, and we think, there's the place to send my child. But the evidence suggests that the thing we are convinced is such a big advantage might not be such an advantage at all. 3. Not long ago, I sat down with one of the most powerful people in Hollywood. He began by talking about his childhood in Minneapolis. He would go up and down the streets of his neighborhood at the beginning of every winter, he said, getting commitments from people who wanted their driveways and sidewalks cleared of snow. Then he would contract out each job to other children in the neighborhood. He paid his workers the moment the job was done, with cash on hand, and collected from the families later, because he learned that was the surest way to get his crew to work hard. He had 8, sometimes 9 kids on the payroll. In the fall, he would switch to raking leaves. I would go and check their work so I could tell the customer that their driveway would be done the way they wanted it done, he remembered. There would always be 1 or 2 kids who didn't do it well, and I would have to fire them. He was 10 years old. By the age of 11, he had $600 in the bank, all earned by himself. This was in the 1950s. That would be the equivalent today of $5,000. I didn't have money for where I wanted to go, he said with a shrug, as if it was obvious that an 11-year-old would have a sense of where he wanted to go. Any fool can spend money, but to earn it and save it and defer gratification, then you learn to value it differently. His family lived in what people euphemistically called a mixed neighborhood. He went to public schools and wore hand-me-downs. His father was a product of the Depression, and he talked plainly about money. The man from Hollywood said that if he wanted something, a new pair of running shoes, say, or a bicycle, his father would tell him he had to pay half. If he left the lights on, his father would show him the electric bill. He'd say, "Look, this is what we pay for electricity. You're just being lazy not turning the lights off. We're paying for you being lazy. But if you need the lights for working, 24 hours a day, no problem." The summer of his 16th year, he went to work at his father's scrap metal business. It was hard, physical labor. He was treated like any other employee. "It made me not want to live in Minneapolis," he said. "It made me never want to depend on working for my father. It was awful. It was dirty. It was hard. It was boring. It was putting scrap metal in barrels. I worked there from May 15th through Labor Day. I couldn't get the dirt off me. I think, looking back, my father wanted me to work there because he knew that if I worked there, I would want to escape. I would be motivated to do something more." In college, he ran a laundry service, picking up and delivering dry cleaning for his wealthy classmates. He organized student charter flights to Europe. He went to see basketball games with his friend and sat in terrible seats, obstructed by a pillar, and wondered what it would be like to sit in the premium seats courtside. He went to business school and law school in New York and lived in a bad neighborhood in Brooklyn to save money. After graduation, he got a job in Hollywood, which led to a bigger job and then to an even bigger job and side deals and prizes and a string of extraordinary successes to the point where he now has a house in Beverly Hills the size of an airplane hangar, his own jet, a Ferrari in the garage, and a gate in front of his seemingly never-ending driveway that looks like it was shipped over from some medieval castle in Europe. He understood money, and he understood money because he felt he had been given a thorough education in its value and function back home on the streets of Minneapolis. I wanted to have more freedom. I wanted to aspire to have different things. Money was a tool that I could use for my aspiration and my desires and my drive, he said. Nobody taught me that. I learned it. It was kind of like trial and error. I liked the juice of it. I got some self-esteem from it. I felt more control over my life. He was sitting in his home office as he said that, a room easily the size of most people's houses. And then he finally came to the point. He had children that he loved very dearly. Like any parent, he wanted to provide for them, to give them more than he had. But he had created a giant contradiction, and he knew it. He was successful because he had learned the long and hard way about the value of money and the meaning of work and the joy and fulfillment that come from making your own way in the world. But because of his success, it would be difficult for his children to learn those same lessons. Children of multimillionaires in Hollywood do not rake the leaves of their neighbors in Beverly Hills. Their fathers do not wave the electricity bill angrily at them if they leave the lights on. They do not sit in a basketball arena behind a pillar and wonder what it would be like to sit courtside. They live courtside. My own instinct is that it's much harder than anybody believes to bring up kids in a wealthy environment, he said. People are ruined by challenged economic lives. But they're ruined by wealth as well, because they lose their ambition, and they lose their pride, and they lose their sense of self-worth. It's difficult at both ends of the spectrum. There's some place in the middle which probably works best of all. There are few things that inspire less sympathy than a multimillionaire crying the blues for his children, of course. The man from Hollywood's children will never live in anything but the finest of houses and sit anywhere but in first class. But he wasn't talking about material comforts. He was a man who had made a great name for himself. One of his brothers had taken over the family scrap metal business and prospered. Another of his brothers had become a doctor and built a thriving medical practice. His father had produced three sons who were fulfilled and motivated and who had accomplished something for themselves in the world. And his point was that it was going to be harder for him, as a man with hundreds of millions of dollars, to be as successful in raising his children as his father had been back in a mixed neighborhood of Minneapolis. 4. The man from Hollywood is not the first person to have had this revelation. It is something, I think, that most of us understand intuitively. There is an important principle that guides our thinking about the relationship between parenting and money, and that principle is that more is not always better. It's hard to be a good parent if you have too little money. That much is obvious. Poverty is exhausting and stressful. If you have to work two jobs to make ends meet, it's hard to have the energy in the evening to read to your children before they go to bed. If you are a working, single parent, trying to pay your rent and feed and clothe your family and manage a long and difficult commute to a physically demanding job, it's hard to provide your children with the kind of consistent love and attention and discipline that makes for a healthy home. But no one would ever say that it's always true, the more money you have, the better parent you can be. The relationship between money and parenting is not linear, as a mathematician would say. Money makes parenting easier until a certain point, when it stops making much of a difference. What is that point? The scholars who research happiness suggest that more money stops making people happier at a family income of around $75,000 a year. After that, what economists call diminishing marginal returns sets in. If your family makes $75,000 and your neighbor makes $100,000, that extra $25,000 a year means that your neighbor can drive a nicer car and go out to eat slightly more often, but it doesn't make your neighbor happier than you or better equipped at doing the thousands of small and large things that make for being a good parent. But that only tells part of the story, doesn't it? Because when the income of parents gets high enough, then parenting starts to be harder again. For most of us, the values of the world we grew up in are not that different from the world we create for our children. But that's not true for someone who becomes very wealthy. The psychologist James Grubman uses the wonderful expression immigrants to wealth to describe first-generation millionaires, by which he means that they face the same kinds of challenges in relating to their children that immigrants to any new country face. Someone like the Hollywood mogul grew up in the old country of the middle class, where scarcity was a great motivator and teacher. His father taught him the meaning of money and the virtues of independence and hard work. But his children live in the new world of riches, where the rules are different and baffling. How do you teach work hard, be independent, learn the meaning of money to children who look around themselves and realize that they never have to work hard, be independent, or learn the meaning of money? That's why so many cultures around the world have a proverb to describe the difficulty of raising children in an atmosphere of wealth. In English, the saying is, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. The Italians say, from stars to stables. In Spain, it's, he who doesn't have it, does it, and he who has it, misuses it. Wealth contains the seeds of its own destruction. A parent has to set limits, but that's one of the most difficult things for immigrants to wealth, because they don't know what to say when having the excuse of, we can't afford it, is gone, Grubman says. They don't want to lie and say, we don't have the money, because if you have a teenager, the teenager says, excuse me, you have a Porsche, and mom has a Maserati. The parents have to learn to switch from, no, we can't, to, no, we won't. But no, we won't, Grubman said, is much harder. No, we can't is simple. Sometimes as a parent, you have to say it only once or twice. It doesn't take long for the child of a middle-class family to realize that it is pointless to ask for a pony, because a pony simply can't happen. No, we won't get a pony requires a conversation and the honesty and skill to explain that what is possible is not always what is right. I'll walk wealthy parents through the scenario, and they have no idea what to say, Grubman said. I have to teach them. Yes, I can buy that for you, but I choose not to. It is not consistent with our values. But then that, of course, requires that you have a set of values and know how to articulate them and know how to make them plausible to your child, all of which are really difficult things for anyone to do under any circumstances, and especially if you have a Ferrari in the driveway, a private jet, and a house in Beverly Hills the size of an airplane hangar. The man from Hollywood had too much money. That was his problem as a parent. He was well past the point where money made things better and well past the point where money stopped mattering all that much. He was at the point where money starts to make the job of raising normal and well-adjusted children more difficult. If you had to draw a graph describing the man from Hollywood's predicament, it would look like a camel's hump. The curve would start out positive, then go neutral, then turn negative. That's what's called an inverted U-curve. U-shaped curves are hard to understand. They almost never fail to take us by surprise, and one of the reasons we are so often confused about advantages and disadvantages is that we forget when we are operating in a U-shaped world. Which brings us back to the puzzle of class size. What if the relationship between the number of children in a classroom and academic performance is not linear? What if it's not diminishing marginal returns? What if, in fact, it's an inverted U-shaped curve? The principal of Chepauk Valley Middle School is a woman named Teresa DeBrito. In her 5-year tenure at the school, she has watched the incoming class dwindle year by year. To a parent, that might seem like good news. But when she thought about it, she had the U-shaped curve in mind. In a few years, we're going to have fewer than 50 kids for the whole grade coming up from elementary school, she said. She was dreading it. We're going to struggle. 5. Inverted U-shaped curves have 3 parts, and each part follows a different logic. There's the left side, where doing more or having more makes things better. There is the flat middle, where doing more doesn't make much of a difference. And there's the right side, where doing more or having more makes things worse. If you think about the class size puzzle this way, then what seems baffling starts to make a little more sense. The number of students in a class is like the amount of money a parent has. It all depends on where you are on the curve. Israel, for example, has historically had quite large elementary school classes. The country's educational system uses the Maimonides rule, named after the 12th century rabbi who decreed that classes should not exceed 40 children. That means elementary school classes can often have as many as 38 or 39 students. Where there are 40 students in a grade, though, the same school could suddenly have two classes of 20. If you do a Hauksbee-style analysis and compare the performance of one of those big classes with a class of 20, the small class will do better. That shouldn't be surprising. 36 or 37 students is a lot for any teacher to handle. Israel is on the left side of the inverted U-curve. Now think back to Connecticut. In the schools Hauksbee looked at, most of the variation was between class sizes in the mid to low 20s and those in the high teens. When Hauksbee says that her study found nothing, what she means is that she could find no real benefit to making classes smaller in that medium range. Somewhere between Israel and Connecticut, in other words, the effects of class size move along the curve to the flat middle, where adding resources to the classroom stops translating into a better experience for children. Why isn't there much of a difference between a class of 25 students and a class of 18 students? There's no question that the latter is easier for the teacher, fewer papers to grade, fewer children to know and follow. But a smaller classroom only translates to a better outcome if teachers change their teaching style when given a lower workload. And what the evidence suggests is that in this mid-range, teachers don't necessarily do that. They just work less. This is only human nature. Imagine that you are a doctor and you suddenly learn that you'll see 20 patients on a Friday afternoon instead of 25 while getting paid the same. Would you respond by spending more time with each patient? Or would you simply leave at 6:30 instead of 7:30 and have dinner with your kids? Now for the crucial question. Can a class be too small, the same way a parent can make too much money? I polled a large number of teachers in the United States and Canada and asked them that question, and teacher after teacher agreed that it can. Here's a typical response. My perfect number is 18. That's enough bodies in the room that no one person needs to feel vulnerable, but everyone can feel important. 18 divides handily into groups of 2 or 3 or 6, all varying degrees of intimacy in and of themselves. With 18 students, I can always get to each one of them when I need to. 24 is my second favorite number. The extra 6 bodies make it even more likely that there will be a dissident among them, a rebel or two to challenge the status quo. But the trade-off with 24 is that it verges on having the energetic mass of an audience instead of a team. Add 6 more of them to hit 30 bodies, and we've weakened the energetic connections so far that even the most charismatic of teachers can't maintain the magic all the time. And what about the other direction? Drop down 6 from the perfect 18 bodies, and we have the Last Supper. And that's the problem. 12 is small enough to fit around the holiday dinner table, too intimate for many high schoolers to protect their autonomy on the days they need to, and too easily dominated by the bombast or bully, either of whom could be the teacher herself. By the time we shrink to 6 bodies, there is no place to hide at all, and not enough diversity in thought and experience to add the richness that can come from numbers. The small class is, in other words, potentially as difficult for a teacher to manage as the very large class. In one case, the problem is the number of potential interactions to manage. In the other case, it is the intensity of the potential interactions. As another teacher memorably put it, when a class gets too small, the students start acting like siblings in the back seat of a car. There is simply no way for the cantankerous kids to get away from one another. Here's another comment from a high school teacher. He had recently had a class of 32 and hated it. When I face a class that large, the first thought I have is, damn it, every time I collect something to mark, I'm going to spend hours of time here at the school when I could be with my own kids. But he didn't want to teach a class of fewer than 20 either. The life source of any class is discussion, and that tends to need a certain critical mass to get going. I teach classes right now with students who simply don't discuss anything, and it's brutal at times. If the numbers get too low, discussion suffers. That seems counterintuitive, because I would think that the quiet kids who would hesitate to speak in a class of 32 would do so more readily in a class of 16. But that hasn't been my experience. The quiet ones tend to be quiet regardless. And if the class is too small, among the speakers, you don't have enough breadth of opinion, perhaps, to get things really going. There's also something very hard to pin down about energy level. A very small group tends to lack that sort of energy that comes from the friction between people. And a really, really small class? Beware. Here's one more teacher. I had a class of 9 students in grade 12 academic French. Sounds like a dream, doesn't it? It was a nightmare. You can't get any kind of conversation or discussion going in the target language. It's difficult to play games to reinforce vocabulary, grammar skills, etc. The momentum just isn't there. The economist Jesse Levin has done some fascinating work along these same lines, looking at Dutch school children. He counted how many peers children had in their class, that is, students at a similar level of academic ability, and found that the number of peers had a surprising correlation with academic performance, particularly for struggling students. In other words, if you are a student, particularly a poor student, what you need is to have people around you asking the same questions, wrestling with the same issues, and worrying about the same things as you are, so that you feel a little less isolated and a little more normal. This is the problem with really small classes, Levin argues. When there are too few students in a room, the chances that children are surrounded by a critical mass of other people like them starts to get really low. Taken too far, Levin says, class size reduction steals away the peers that struggling students learn from. Can you see why Teresa DeBrito was so worried about Chepauk Valley? She's the principal of a middle school, teaching children at precisely the age when they begin to make the difficult transition to adolescence. They are awkward and self-conscious and anxious about seeming too smart. Getting them to engage, to move beyond simple question and answer sessions with their teacher, she said, can be like pulling teeth. She wanted lots of interesting and diverse voices in her classrooms, and the kind of excitement that comes from a critical mass of students grappling with the same problem. How do you do that in a half-empty room? The more students you have, she continued, the more variety you can have in those discussions. If it's too small with kids this age, it's like they have a muzzle on. She didn't say it, but you could imagine her thinking that if someone went and built a massive subdivision on the gently rolling meadow next to the school, she wouldn't be all that unhappy. I started in Meriden as a middle school math teacher, DeBrito went on. Meriden is a middle and lower income city in another part of the state. My largest class was 29 kids. She talked about how hard that was, how much work it took to follow and know and respond to that many students. You've got to be able to have eyes in the back of your head. You've got to be able to hear what's happening when you're working with a particular group. You have to really be on top of your game when you have that many kids in a classroom, so that over there in a corner, they're not just talking about something that has nothing to do with what they're supposed to be working on. But then she made a confession. She liked teaching that class. It was one of the best years of her career. The great struggle for someone teaching math to 12 and 13-year-olds is to make it seem exciting. And 29 kids was exciting. There were so many more peers to interact with, she said. They weren't always relating with just this one group. There was more opportunity to vary your experiences. And that's the real issue. What can be done to enliven, enrich, and engage the child so they aren't just being passive? Did she want 29 children in every classroom at Chepauk? Of course not. DeBrito knew that she was a bit unusual and that the ideal number for most teachers was lower than that. Her point was simply that on the question of class size, We have become obsessed with what is good about small classrooms and oblivious of what can also be good about large classes. It's a strange thing, isn't it, to have an educational philosophy that thinks of the other students in the classroom with your child as competitors for the attention of the teacher and not allies in the adventure of learning. When she thought back to that year in Meriden, DeBrito got a faraway look in her eyes. I liked the noise. I liked to hear them interact. Oh, it was fun. 6. A half-hour drive up the road from Chippewa Valley, in the town of Lakeville, Connecticut, is a school called Hotchkiss. It is considered one of the premier private boarding schools in the United States. Tuition is almost $50,000 a year. The school has 2 lakes, 2 hockey rinks, 4 telescopes, a golf course, and 12 pianos. And not just any pianos, but as the school takes pains to point out, Steinway pianos, the most prestigious piano money can buy. Hotchkiss is the kind of place that spares no expense in the education of its students. The school's average class size, 12. The same condition that Teresa DeBrito dreads, Hotchkiss, just up the road, advertises as its greatest asset. Our learning environment, the school proudly declares, is intimate, interactive, and inclusive. Why does a school like Hotchkiss do something that so plainly makes its students worse off? One answer is that the school isn't thinking of its students. It's thinking of the parents of its students who see things like golf courses and Steinway pianos and small classes as evidence that their $50,000 a year is well spent. But the better answer is that Hotchkiss has simply fallen into the trap that wealthy people and wealthy institutions and wealthy countries, that Goliaths, all too often fall into. The school assumes that the kinds of things that wealth can buy always translate into real-world advantages. They don't, of course. That's the lesson of the inverted U-curve. It is good to be bigger and stronger than your opponent. It is not so good to be so big and strong that you're a sitting duck for a rock fired at 150 miles per hour. Goliath didn't get what he wanted because he was too big. The man from Hollywood was not the parent he wanted to be because he was too rich. Hotchkiss is not the school it wants to be because its classes are too small. We all assume that being bigger and stronger and richer is always in our best interest. Vivek Ranadeve, a shepherd boy named David, and the principal of Chippewa Valley Middle School will tell you that it isn't.